VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, Brian Lynn presents this week's technology report. John Russell has a story about the rising popularity in school gardening. We close our show with the next episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Katie Weaver.
American Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to Vietnam was delayed for a few hours on Tuesday. Officials said two possible cases of Havana syndrome among American workers in the country led to the delay. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Tuesday that the cases had not been confirmed and did not involve anyone traveling with Harris. Havana syndrome is the name for a series of mysterious health incidents first reported by American diplomats and other government employees in the Cuban capital in late 2016. Sufferers reported hearing loud noise, loss of balance, intense head pressure, and vision problems. Many continued to experience these or other health problems for some time. Similar unexplained incidents have since been reported by U.S. officials and family members in other countries, including Germany, Austria, Russia, and China. Especially worrying are the discoveries of at least two possible incidents around Washington, D.C. One happened near the White House last November. Following the reports from Havana, U.S. officials told the Associated Press and other news organizations that the diplomats had been exposed to a sound device that operated outside the range of normal hearing. It was not immediately clear if the device was a weapon or had some other purpose. Officials added investigators were looking into the possibilities that the incidents were carried out by a third country, such as Russia. Russia denied any involvement. The University of Pennsylvania's Center for Brain Injury and Repair did a study in 2018 to compare the brain images of 40 Americans stationed in Havana with other healthy individuals. The study found evidence that American diplomats experienced some form of brain injury in Havana. Another study, published last December in the National Academy of Sciences, identifies directed pulsed radio frequency energy to be the most probable cause of Havana syndrome. James Giordano is a professor at Georgetown University. He has worked with the State Department on investigating the Havana cases. Giordano told the AP last May that there is evidence of brain injuries in several people, suggesting they may have been affected by radio waves. He identified two possible sources. One is a device used to directly target people. Another is a tool that used energy waves for intelligence gathering. Some scientists, however, disagreed with the findings. Robert Ballo is a medical doctor from the University of California, Los Angeles. He and Robert Bartholomew of Botany College in New Zealand wrote in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, "The most likely explanation for the recent outbreak of mysterious symptoms in Cuba and elsewhere is mass psychogenic illness." A mass psychogenic illness is when people learn of sickness among others in their group and begin to feel sick themselves. I'm Katie Weaver.
School gardening has become very popular during the coronavirus health crisis, with families and teachers saying its hands-on lessons can be used to teach many subjects. Finding the money to keep a school garden going can be tough. Some experts and teachers, however, are finding creative ways to make it work. Susan Hobart is a retired elementary school teacher at Lakeview Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin. She oversees the school's large garden with 12 raised beds. Gardens are a great way to get kids outside with a purpose. With gardens, kids get to see a beginning, a middle, and an end to their project with tangible results, she said. Tangible means easily seen or recognized. Hobart added that the gardens help calm the kids and give them a whole different perspective they wouldn't have just sitting at desks. Each spring, the school's program gets plant seedlings grown through a training program at a nearby prison. A church group comes during spring break to prepare the garden for the children's return. Over the summer, a volunteer takes care of the garden. If we had to buy the seedlings, they'd cost $3 each, and we could never afford that, Hobart says. If you take a look at your relationships and the community around you, and then all the wider networks out there, there are plenty of creative ways to find help. Toby Adams directs the New York Botanical Gardens Edible Academy, where schoolchildren learn about growing food. Adams said that interest in school gardens increased after Michelle Obama planted a garden at the White House and invited schoolchildren to help. Adams added that there has been another increase in interest since the coronavirus health crisis started. School gardens can teach lessons in health, science, social studies, and even arts classes. Giving kids the opportunity to move outside, get their hands dirty, and find worms, especially if their teachers are excited about it, that's huge, Adams said. For schools without space for even a small garden, turning to local botanical gardens and parks can sometimes be the answer. We are located in the Bronx, which is basically wall-to-wall six-story apartments. There's limited space and vandalism, and it's hard to find a good place to gather 30 kids, not to mention issues like water access, says Adams. Adams said that gardens do not have to take up a large area outdoors. It could be a container garden. There are all kinds of gardens and ways it can work, he said. I'm John Russell.
Thank you. the chief of American electric car maker Tesla says the company aims to complete a humanoid robot by next year. Elon Musk said last week that the robot, called Tesla Bot, will be designed to perform jobs that people do not like to do. He added that the human-like machine would be based on the same artificial intelligence technology that Tesla uses in its automobiles. This includes a complex system of cameras and other devices to help the robot operate in real-world situations. Musk said the machine, which will stand about 1.7 meters tall, is intended to be friendly, of course. It will be designed to navigate through a world built for humans, he added. The company chief described the plans during a public presentation about Tesla's latest AI systems. Musk said the Tesla bot will use a lot of the same technology that goes into the company's electric vehicles. It kind of makes sense to put that onto a humanoid form, he said. However, he repeated that the main purpose of the humanoid robot would be to take over jobs that are dangerous, repetitive, and boring to people. In the future, physical work will be a choice. If you want to do it, you can, but you won't need to do it, Musk said. He added, for example, that the humanoid robot would be able to understand simple instructions and perform duties as directed. Such instructions could involve work related to manufacturing or picking up food for people at the store. Musk did not provide specific details about how Tesla's current systems would fit in with the operating model of the humanoid robot. The use of such robots in manufacturing settings has the possibility to change the world's economy, Musk said. This is because it could help deal with labor shortages that are currently a problem. What is the economy? At the foundation of it is labor, he told the crowd gathered for the company's presentation. Is there any actual limit to the economy? Maybe not. The event was held days after a U.S. government safety agency said it was investigating a series of crashes involving Tesla cars. The crashes involved the company's driver assistance systems. Musk did not comment on that decision during the company event. He repeated, however, that Tesla is confident that its full self-driving system will perform at higher safety levels than human drivers. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said it had identified 11 crashes involving Tesla models that struck emergency vehicles that were parked on the road. The accidents resulted in one death and 17 injuries. The agency said it had confirmed that the Tesla cars involved were using either the company's autopilot or traffic-aware cruise control systems just before the crashes. Both systems use a series of cameras and other devices to assist drivers. Some industry experts questioned whether the humanoid robot described by Musk would become a reality. The Tesla chief has a history of announcing product launches that face major delays or are canceled. Raj Rajkumar is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Speaking to Reuters, he asked, "Is the Tesla bot the next dream shot to pump up the hype machine?" Rajkumar added, "I can safely say that it will be much longer than 10 years before a humanoid bot from any company on the planet can go to the store and get groceries for you." I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1801, America had a new president, Thomas Jefferson from the state of Virginia. Jefferson had already done much for his country. He wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He served as America's first ambassador to France and the first Secretary of State. Now he would govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson was happy and hopeful as he took office. His new political party, the Republicans, had defeated the older Federalist Party. The Federalists had controlled the cabinet and the Congress during President George Washington's two terms. George Washington was not a Federalist, but America's second president, John Adams, was. Altogether, the Federalists had been in power for 12 years. The Federalists and the Republicans held very different opinions about how to govern the nation. The Federalists feared that Jefferson and his followers would destroy the social order of the new country. And Jefferson's Republican Party feared that the Federalists would put power in the hands of a few elite people.
The fears of neither side were really justified. But it was a remarkable moment because the election of 1800 was extremely partisan. But it was also the first occasion in which power was exchanged from one party to another without any kind of violence or a revolution.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs an international center for Jefferson studies at Thomas Jefferson's home called Monticello. He says emotions between the Federalists and the Republicans were still strong when Jefferson took office. But in his inaugural address, the new president extended the hand of peace and friendship to the Federalists. In his words, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." The leader of the Federalist Party, Alexander Hamilton, did not accept Jefferson's offer of friendship. As Jefferson became president, Hamilton made a speech attacking him. Hamilton had decided to continue fighting the Democratic movement in the United States. But Hamilton's opposition did not worry Jefferson. "Of course," he said, "the top leaders of the Federalists, men like Hamilton, could never be changed. He was more interested in bringing their followers to his side. He was sure he could show even the Federalists that his program was good for all." In fact,
Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Jefferson expected the Federalist Party just to disappear. He says people in Jefferson's time did not think a two-party system was essential to democracy.
They thought if people acted in a public spirit and put aside their own self-interest, that they would all recognize the common good and act together.
And he says Jefferson believed his party, the Republicans, represented the true spirit of the American Revolution. In those early days of 1801, Jefferson said, "We can no longer say that there is nothing new under the sun. What we have done in this country is all new. The force of public opinion is new. But the most important and pleasing newness is that we have changed our government without violence. This shows a strength of American character that will give long life to our republic. We have proved that freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of thought are necessary in a healthy nation. Let men argue with each other. The arguments may become bitter, but the bitterness is just a cloud that passes. And out of the arguments will come the truth. As for the Federalist leaders, they, except for Hamilton, believed Jefferson's friendly words in his inaugural speech showed he would respect their party. George Cabot, the strongest Federalist leader in New England, usually agreed with Hamilton, but now he did not. Cabot said, "I believe that our new president wants to stay out of war. We do not have to worry any longer that he plans to join France against England. He is friendly to us and wants our help. Therefore, I am sure that he will not dismiss any of our people from their government positions." Another Federalist leader, Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State under President Adams, said, "I am satisfied that Jefferson will not make any important changes in government policy and that he will depend for support more on us Federalists than on the Democrats." During those first few weeks of the new government, the Federalist leaders really believed that Jefferson was afraid of them. They believed that he had surrendered to them and would be destroyed as the leader of the Republican Party. One Federalist wrote, "Soon Jefferson will feel the bite of his dirty Democrats when they attack him." Jefferson soon did hear complaints from Republican leaders who felt he was being too kind to the Federalists. William Giles, a Jeffersonian leader in Virginia, wrote, "Of course I am very pleased by the president's inaugural speech. The president's program is correct. It agrees with the opinions of the people. But I still think that the president's success will depend on how he carries out his program. Let him offer friendship to the Federalists, but he must not permit friendship to become weakness. His friends believe that the first thing he must do is to clean out the executive branch of the government. He must dismiss from office all men who are enemies of the Republican program." Even James Monroe wrote a strong letter to the president, "Your speech and your program are healthy and good, but there are serious dangers ahead of you. There are two parties in this country, not one. One of these parties, the Federalists, has controlled the government for 12 years and has hurt our nation greatly. Some of these Federalists now speak softly to you and promise their support. But you must remember, too, that there are thousands of good Republicans who have always supported you. If you keep Federalists in office, if you appoint Federalists to office, many of these good Republicans will stop believing in you. Certainly, there is no reason why you should give jobs to men who worked for the Federalist government of John Adams. Certainly, you must throw out the officials of the last government who stole money and sold their services. Do this, and you will give strength to our Republican movement. Please understand me. I am speaking only of high offices. I do not ask that you dismiss small officials because they are Federalists. They have a right to their political beliefs. Let them keep their jobs. This will show that you are a president who can accept different political opinions. As Federalists and Republican leaders kept asking Jefferson for positions in the government, the president was thinking of his cabinet. He quickly decided who would be his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. James Madison of Virginia, Jefferson's old friend and the father of the Constitution, would be Secretary of State. For Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson chose Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, the brilliant leader of the Republicans in Congress. Gallatin understood economics and finance as well as Alexander Hamilton did. For the War Department, Jefferson turned to General Henry Dearborn of New England. Jefferson's first choice to be Secretary of the Navy was Judge Robert Livingston, the great lawyer from New York. But Judge Livingston rejected this position. Jefferson finally chose Robert Smith of Baltimore, Maryland. The president had already appointed one man from New England to his cabinet, Secretary of War Dearborn. Now he turned to New England for two more appointments. Jefferson knew that the strength of the Federalist Party was greater in New England than in any other part of the country. He believed that there was no better way to move New England away from the Federalist program than to give cabinet positions to men from New England. And so, Jefferson found his attorney general in Levi Lincoln of Massachusetts. Like Dearborn, Lincoln was a patriot of the American Revolution. He had been a supporter of Jefferson from the beginning. He was famous as a lawyer in Massachusetts, where he was the top leader of the Republican Party. Jefferson turned to New England as well for the Postmaster General. It was not yet a cabinet office, but its importance was growing. The president gave this appointment to Gideon Granger, a lawyer, businessman, and writer. Granger was one of the strong Jeffersonians in the state of Connecticut. Such was Jefferson's cabinet, all strong Republicans, all completely loyal. The Federalists were shocked. Not one member of their party had been appointed.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.